Maddie's Mental Health Podcast, aiming to spread awareness on mental health by sharing the real life stories.
All right, Will Stevenson is here today with us. How are you doing, Will?
Good, Matt. How are you?
Doing well. What's going on today?
Oh, just thought I'd come in and talk a little bit about mental health. Because I am an advocate like yourself, I very much want my story out there, so maybe we can help somebody.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for you reached out and wanted to come on. We are in the Virtual Creation Studio, by the way, Charlottetown, so go check out the studio for all your business creation needs. So let's jump into it. Well, tell me a little bit about your story and what kind of made you want to reach out.
Oh, boy. Well, I guess where would you like me to start? Kind of at the beginning, like I was born at a very early age and go from there? Or?
I mean, anywhere you want. I mean, maybe even just what made you want to come on the podcast? Maybe starting there and then we can get into your story.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, so what made me want to come on the podcast is, do you mind if I'm not going to plug my podcast?
But of course, plug your podcast, do it away.
Okay, I have a podcast on Anchor, everybody. It's called The Hip Chronic. Full warnings ahead of time. It's mature content. It's also me. I'm a cannabis advocate as well because cannabis, I was prescribed cannabis at one point, and it very much helps me with my day-to-day and just being in the moment. I'm an advocate for cannabis. As you tell, cannabis affects the memory sometimes, I guess. I do have short-term memory loss, though, as part of my my diagnosis, which we'll talk about in a bit, I guess. But so what made me want to come on was talking about mental health and stigmas and helping break those stigmas. And I had reached out to somebody in the psychology department at UPEI for my second upcoming episode. I have some questions that I wanted to kind of talk about on the podcast. And after speaking with this person for a while, one of the professors there, they had recommended that I reach out to you, and that's kind of how we got connected. So glad we did, and glad we're here, I guess. So pretty nervous, but here we are.
So thank you, thank you so much for taking the step and reaching out and wanting to share your story.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Shout out to Annabelle, right? Annabelle Cohen.
It is. Yeah, I wasn't sure if I should mention the name, but if you feel comfortable, have at it. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
She's a psychology department at UPEI.
Yeah.
Yeah, shout out to her. If you're in the UPEI space, or if you know her. If you know her, shout out to her.
Hey, I heard your name on the news the other day. Well, it's not really the news, I guess, but it's good news.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, let's get into a little bit about your story. So where did mental health start for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, mental health, really, if you look at my story, it started back when I was about 4 years old, or six, depending on, you know, my version or my sister's version. I was taken away from my mother when I was four or six. I had lived in foster homes and through a series of events, here I am. I'm 47, going to be 48 in September. I always say I'm 48, but that's weird that I said 47. I was diagnosed with PTSD, general anxiety disorder, and ADHD, I think it is. I honestly don't remember if it's ADHD or ADD. I take three different medications. One's for allergies, oddly enough, so it's got nothing to do with that. But that's kind of when it came about for me, and I've struggled with employment my whole life. I've been virtually fired or quit from every position I've ever had. There's a lot to go into, so I don't really know. That's kind of where it came from.
Okay. I guess just on that point, you just mentioned it, like what's the biggest obstacle you find with employment in particular?
Okay, so on any given day when I wake up, I don't know what that day is going to bring. I mean, I'm trying very hard. My wife, I have to give a huge shout out to my wife and her family because they've been a rock for me. Without them, I definitely would not be here. And I know that sounds kind of cliche, but it's very much true. And she's helped me see the kind of brighter side of things. So, but any given day I could wake up and I could be amazing mentally. I could be ready to conquer the world. I could be ready to do the next podcast, or I could sit on the couch for 14 hours staring off into space because I just don't know what to do with myself. Or, you know, I could be pissed off. Sorry, am I allowed to? Yeah, okay. So I could be pissed off at the world right off the bat. And I don't know why sometimes, you know. I know it's all got to do with my PTSD and things that have happened in the past, but that's generally it, you know. You never know. So it's a. I tell people that, like, friends of mine, I talk to them a lot about mental health, and some of them, you know, they have their own issues. And I say, you know, it's not one thing that'll work. It's not the therapy that'll work. It's not the pills that'll work. It's not the tools in your repertoire that'll work. It's everything in coordination. And some things don't work. Some things just generally don't work with certain people, or genuinely, not generally. You know, maybe that certain medication that your doctor has prescribed you doesn't work for you. And I'm not telling anyone to do that. Obviously, talk to your doctor. But some medications obviously might not have an effect on somebody's certain brain chemistry. So it's very much about finding a balance. These days, my life is, when I can control it, it's all about finding the Zen moment and doing what I feel, you know, would be my my reason for being. I realized that the other day, actually, and that's a true story. I was on the patio, and yes, I was smoking and meditating. I tend to do mindfulness meditation, thanks to John McMillan. He's a friend of mine, I guess. Well, he's my therapist, but he's also a friend. Hey, John.
Friend and therapist.
There you go.
It's
yeah,
a good combination.
It is a good combination. Not like we hang out or anything, but, you know, he's a good guy. And he had introduced me to mindfulness meditation, and it is a game changer for me. I can focus and be in that moment. In fact, I have a tattoo, and I'm going to mention it now because my friends used to get sick of it, but overthinking, overanalyzing separates the body from the mind. It's a quote from the band Tool, which I've grown to love over the years. And it really says to me, and it's a reminder when I look at my arm, that shut up, mind, shut up, brain, you know, just be here, be here in this podcast right now. And this is interesting too, because I have to find this kind of balance where I can go back into the really shitty, hurtful stuff while maintaining, you know, a modicum of composure, because here I am doing this podcast where I'm trying to help people and talk to people. And so that, you know, like I say to my friends, it's something that you need to be conscious about. So mindfulness comes into play. You consciously make the effort to get out and go for that walk, to go for that hike, to take time for yourself, to celebrate the small wins. That's something a lot of people I find, and I can only speak for, you know, the things I'm diagnosed with in my own experiences, but from my experiences, the people that I've talked to who have PTSD, they have a hard time with their self-worth sometimes. They have a hard time with confidence, and so it's very important that we kind of celebrate those small wins. I'm not talking like you're going to have a parade because you get out of bed today, but you know what? You get out of bed and you went for a walk, effing right on, you know, like you owe it to yourself to give yourself a high five, I guess, mentally. Yeah. Or physically if you want, I guess. It's kind of weird though. Yeah. I like how we both did it at the same time. That's pretty cool. Pat yourself on the back. There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's, that seems like it's common for people with other diagnoses, but, you know, maybe for everyone too, but yeah, celebrating the wins. I was actually just having a conversation with someone yesterday, kind of relating to this. It was actually like a client that I work with, but it was like, we're talking about how, like often we, kind of congratulate ourselves, or we feel like, we're proud of ourselves.
Sure.
for big achievements,
right?
Like, and it's like something that's like tangible that we can see, like we worked really hard and we entered a competition and then we won the competition.
Yeah, we won the medal or
we won the medal or whatever it is, you know. And that's kind of like a simplified example, right? But it's like something that we put effort into and then we saw the result. What we don't always give ourselves credit for is like making through a time where we couldn't even get out of bed, but we still managed to do it. Or the time where we were going through something terrible. You know, that could be like acute, or that could be over years where it's like you learn to cope, and you like, you know, where you were when you started, or where you were from 10 years ago to where you are now is a completely different place. We don't necessarily look at that from a bigger scale and be like, oh, well, you know, I fucking did something here.
Right. And that's, I think it's important that we all kind of do that. You know?
Yeah.
So it's funny. We're not taught that stuff though. Growing up, honestly, we're not.
Yeah.
We talk about that some other time, but yeah. I have a whole issue with the mental health education system. It's just not there. It's getting there, but it's not there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm talking like through like kindergarten through 12 or whatever. But again, topic for another day, I guess. But
yeah, well, I think even just awareness at a young age and like just mindset things. Like I've talked to a few people that are in the education space, and gives me hope because they they're doing some cool things, but yeah, there's a lot that can be done. Like even I was talking to this I was talking to one girl, and she her thing was she would ask the kids how everyone's doing that day, and then they would, I think it was like she would say like say one nice thing about the person beside you, and then say one thing about nice thing about yourself.
That's hard.
Yeah.
That's hard.
Yeah. Especially for, and it was so interesting, even from a young age, like they struggle so much saying something nice about themselves.
Well, especially if, and don't get me wrong, I love what she's doing. I think it's amazing. But if you have a child who, you know, maybe they struggle with self-worth, confidence, and maybe they're bullied. Mm-hmm. I'm talking from experience, I guess. Yeah. You know, I probably wouldn't say anything nice about myself because I'd be afraid that, you know, somebody would shit on that and I'm going to be outside afterwards getting the shit kicked out of me, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I hope you have a warning for your viewers and your listeners. Sorry, guys.
No, this podcast is rated R. No, maybe like E. E for enter at your own risk.
Yeah. L for life.
L for life.
L for life. This is rated L for life, but not for loser. L for life.
Yeah. R for real life.
Yeah.
R for something like that.
IRL. This is IRL.
When is the first time you remember having a mental health struggle?
A crisis, per se. Yeah. Well, it was that day in either 1978 or 1980. I was born in 74, obviously. 78 or 1980. I lived in Amherst, Nova Scotia. And I can remember, it was such a weird little thing, but my sister had taken me to her friend's house, and I was playing with her son, like the friend's son. And we were playing with dinky cars in the dirt, you know, getting all muddy and stuff. And if I remember correctly, honestly, and I do have a pretty good memory of, it's weird, I don't have a memory about what I watched last night, but I can tell you exactly, you know, what happened 40 years ago or more. But we got in a bit of a fight over a really cool dinky car. It was probably, if I remember right, actually, it was, this is going to sound weird, but it was a little dinky car that you could look through the back window and you could see the Incredible Hulk. It was like a van. It was like a weird, almost like a, what do you call those things? A Viewmaster, if you do remember those. You'd put the little disc in, you'd click it, and you'd see different images.
That's the same
technology, and you could see the Hulk sitting in the front seat, and we probably fought over it, and I walked home. My sister didn't know. And anyway, so I walked home, and it was pouring rain.
So wait, you walked home from school?
No, not from school, from the friend's house where my sister was inside talking to her friend, and we were outside playing with the dinky cars in the yard. And then we got in a fight, and I'm very stubborn, believe it or not. I walked home, and when I got home, it started raining. It started to get dark. My sister was probably freaking out, like wondering where I was. She was probably calling the police and everything. I don't know. All I know is that I sat on the doorstep, and, you know, 4 years old, I'm sitting there crying in the rain because I can't get inside the house. It's dark and probably scared of the dark and everything else. And the neighbors took me in and they called the police. And the next morning, everything was in two garbage bags and I was gone. And that was pretty traumatic for a kid my age. It was the only time I've ever gotten motion sickness, actually, too. I remember driving with the social worker who I actually made contact with probably about 5 or 6 years ago. I went on this journey of trying to find more about myself. And I made contact with my social worker, my old social worker, Gary, the one who kind of took me away. Not his fault. I don't blame him. But I remember he was a pretty cool guy. It was the first time I ever had chicken McNuggets. And I was really into the Dukes of Hazzard at the time. And he gave me a model. And I remember sitting in the seat and I was eating the McNuggets and everything was fine. And as far as I knew, I mean, I knew I was being taken away and I knew I was going to Spring Hill, Nova Scotia to live with somebody. But I was reading the box, the instructions for the model, and I just power puked all over the car and I felt really terrible. And I remember to this day, the car, it was a gray Ford Tempo with a maroon pinstripe. And actually when I went to go see, somebody in town one day, I saw one exactly like it. And it was like, wow, I'm there again. I'm sitting in that front seat. So that was really the first time, I think.
So, you mentioned like the police come.
Yes.
And you were outside of the time waiting to get in. Did you have any idea at that point, like why that was, why you were leaving? And like, was there any other events that like led up to that? I mean, I'm sure that they had the reasons for doing that.
Yeah, not really. I can remember. Well, okay. I was told this, I guess, and it makes total sense. But remember I said I had made a connection there after all these years with some of the foster homes. And one of them I got treated really well at. Not to say that I wasn't treated well at others, but I was treated extremely well at this one place. And I've since connected with them. And my nephew, Dan, who would have been like 4 years old when I left and I was 10, after 30-some years, we reconnect. And my foster sister told me, she's like, she said when she re-met me, I guess, re-met, is that a word? Re-met?
I would say it's a word.
What's a word now? Re-met. So yeah. When we re-met, she said I used to walk around all the time asking her, if like, are you my mom? So I guess I just didn't really understand. I had been in 3 different foster homes over the years, and yeah, it was pretty intense. I mean, you go to the first one, and it was, you know, we're talking in the days of black and white TV, and I didn't even see color TV until I was 10. So rural Nova Scotia, I'm living in Spring Hill at one point with this elderly lady. I don't remember her name, don't know anything about her. All I remember is that she had a son, and he had Tourette's, and he had Down syndrome. And
so that's the first place you go?
That's like, the first place I went.
So like, you're 4 years old, you leave, and that's the first place you go?
Yeah, so I puke in the car, and then we're there. Pretty okay. much, right? By the time we cleaned it up, we're pretty much there. Because, you know, Spring Hill to Amherst. And anyway, that was terrifying as a young kid, not knowing. I was terrified of her son. He was an adult. He probably would have been early 20s, maybe. But I can remember sitting there watching. I was always fascinated by, like, Godzilla and stuff like that when I was a kid. And I'd be sitting there watching Godzilla on Saturday morning TV in black and white, and this young guy behind me screaming, fuck, shit, you know, whatever, and me just being terrified. I remember I cried a lot. And actually, I can remember she did pick up the phone, and she called Gary. It was only about 2 days I was there, maybe, and she said, I can't handle this kid. He won't stop crying. I was a crier, so... emotional guy. I wear my heart in my sleeve, right? And then from there.
But that, yeah, like that would be hard for any kid, any 4-year-old, if you go into this place.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. But that's kind of how it works sometimes, unfortunately, in the child protection world, I guess. You know, sometimes it's not always the best case scenario, but it's... maybe it's a better case scenario, or maybe it's not. Maybe it's just a wrong decision, a wrong fit. Yeah, I think there were some wrong decisions made along the way, obviously, but it is what it is, and it ain't what it ain't, as my therapist would say.
So we'll, of course, share as much or as little about these things as you want.
Sure.
But in terms of your family that you had left, like... was there problems there that, you know, that
yeah.
you were aware of
well,
at that time?
Okay, so my family is an interesting one because we're not really close, and we never really were, I don't believe. I still talk to my sister. She's 9 years older than me. She lives in Halifax, and we talk from time to time. My brother, I haven't talked to him since my mom died, you know, 15 years ago. and didn't talk to him before that for probably 20 years. Like he just kind of left the family. But talking to my sister, I found out a lot. My mother was very secretive. She was a nice lady, but she was very odd, eccentric. She was the lady walking around the neighborhood picking up pop bottles in the ditch, and people would make fun of her. But she'd be the first one that if she found out that you didn't have groceries, like I can remember she'd be going all the time. You know, you could talk to City Taxi. They knew her, you know, by name, whatever. She didn't drive, but she would go and she'd buy double the groceries and she'd make me take them to somebody else's house and that sort of thing. So, but I also know that from what I've heard from my sister, because I don't know a whole lot about my past and her past, but she was abused, I think, quite a bit. And that's something that I've kind of asked myself about various people throughout kind of my healing process is, you know, what happened to them? I forgive you, but what had to happen to you for this to happen? I forgive 95% of the people in my life, like even the ones who did some really shitty stuff and kind of why we're here. You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, so.
I think that's a big perspective shift where it's like, what happened to you that you did these things to me?
Well, that's through a lot of self-discovery, and that's again through, again, I can't help but mention my wife, and I'll probably mention her a lot on this because she's really helped me see that I didn't deserve a lot of the shit that happened, or most of it, or any of it, or whatever, and there's more to life, and that, you know, people aren't inherently bad. I used to kind of have a chip on my shoulder, you know, especially when I was a teenager, because fuck the world and fuck the bullies and fuck this and fuck that and fuck you and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, but it's because of where I had come from and everything that I'd gone through up to that point. But now here I am years later and I don't work. I'm on permanent disability at the moment. And I spend my days, you know, I drum and I go out in nature and I do things that make me happy, and I go and I try to have conversations that are meaningful with people and help people. And in the past, you know, I've volunteered with the Newcomers Association because I understand what it's like to be kind of that outside, you don't quite fit. I never really felt like I fit on PEI for a long time because of the way that I was treated here when I moved here. But I mean, that's a little further ahead in the story, but yeah, I guess I kind of have a roundabout way of answering questions, don't I? I tell a story. I'm a storyteller, right? So I write, and I think I said this to you earlier, but like stories are important. It's more important to me, I think, and more important to humanity than necessarily academic education, because they're real life anecdotes. They're real life situations that people have gone through, or challenges they've had, or even great things that have happened, or funny things. And there's power in that. There's power in laughter. There's power in tears. There's power in real emotion. And I think that a lot of the times the emotions are masked, and that's a societal kind of stigma. It's something else that's slowly changing a little bit, but yeah. So stories are powerful in words.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, I think there's a reason we can all like relate to it, right? When you hear a story, you're hooked in.
Absolutely. Right away. Yeah. And it comes down to, I mean, for lack of anything better at this point, and I don't want to get into, you know, my whole kind of spiritual belief around resonance, but we'll just call it connection. Everyone's craving connection. In fact, I wrote down here a line. I'm a big music guy. And I wrote down a line from Maynard James Keenan, who's the lead singer of Tool, the lead singer of A Perfect Circle, and the lead singer of a band called Pussifer. And in one of the Tool songs called Disillusioned, he says, "You were never an island, unique, voice among the many in this choir." I mean, just think about that. That's powerful. Like, you were never meant to be, we're not meant to be solo. We're meant to be clan dwelling. That's where we come from, and that's where we should be, because that's where the stories. I think the indigenous community has it really, like they had it perfectly set, and they continue to keep those traditions of storytelling because they realized how powerful stories were and are. You know, our heroes, most of our heroes, especially growing up, they come from stories. You know, my hero was Batman. I have a tattoo of Batman. You know, like, until we learn different things, you know, and we change who our heroes might be, maybe they become a sports star or whatever. It's all about the stories, isn't it? Yeah. Kind of lose that fascination and that wonder. That's always bothered me a bit. I hear people say this all the time. I don't have time. Why don't you come camping this weekend? Or why don't you do this? Or why don't you do this? I don't have time. I don't have time. Nobody has time. Everybody has time. And that's all we've got. It's the most valuable commodity we have. Fuck money. Like, money can burn. Who cares? But realistically, time is what we have. And if we don't use it to the best of our ability, what are we doing with it? You know? So to say you don't have time for a lot of things, like, I know, like I mentioned earlier, I play video games. And I've played video games my whole life. I love them. I spent a lot of time alone, you know, in my basement playing video games. I still do. My man cave is in my basement. And I realize that's where I feel very safe and secure. But those are another medium of storytelling. So it's all interconnected. But yeah.
Do you know Joseph Campbell? That's his name? The Hero's Journey?
I do not. Joseph Campbell, The Hero's Journey. Is it a book?
No, it's just like it's basically a story structure.
Okay.
The Hero's Journey. And it's fascinating because, like, almost every story follows it, or every movie follows it.
Right. It's kind of like an archetype.
Yeah. So it's like there's a person, hero, there's a call to action. They go through some sort of adversity.
Sure.
And then they triumph over it, and they come back a changed
makes
person.
Makes sense,
they defeat evil or something, and come back a changed person.
Yeah, it makes sense. You know, I always thought it'd be really cool to take there's a course offered about the psychology of Batman. I thought that'd be really interesting.
Yeah, it would. So.
Yeah. I'll have to check that out, though, for sure.
Yeah. So you're living with this adult with Tourette's,
yes.
This older lady. Can't stay there. So
yeah. So
you're 4 years old at this point.
Yes.
Yeah.
4 or 6. Yeah. But we'll say 4. Okay. So I get taken to another foster home in Port Howe, Nova Scotia, which is a rural community kind of in between. And pardon my geography here. I've been there. I just, I'll say it's between Amherst and Pugwash, put it that way. It's on kind of the Sunset coast or trail there. And it was a farm that I lived on. It was all right. You know, there's some things there that happened, and this is where things can get a little tough to talk about, but I mean, I'm going to go through it because it's, again, I just put a post on Instagram about being here, and I said, you know, this is what I do. I use my voice to talk about these things. So hopefully we can make a connection for somebody and they don't feel all alone, because you're not, there's other people like you. But this one foster home was pretty strict, very religious, gospel hall. I was literally baptized in a river tent revival. Like, you know, there was people came from Florida, people came from different places in RVs, and there's a big white tent set up, and all these people, and they're worshiping God and whatever they do. And then all of a sudden, and I don't mean that facetiously or ignorantly, I was there, I was young, but all of a sudden I'm being in a white robe, dipped into a river, and I couldn't swim, you know. But at the time, you just dunk in and out, you know. But there was also some strange stuff happened at that place, some great memories, but some strange stuff. And yeah, I don't know how much you want me to get into them, I guess. And I'm fine talking about them, by the way. I don't know where you think, like, I know we're having a conversation. Do you want me to tell you what transpired?
Share as much as you want about it.
Sure, yeah. Okay, so I'll start with the good, because the good is, I want to see the positive side of things and make people realize, or help them realize, that even the negatives aren't always 100% negative, I guess. But my foster father, So I used to love going and tinkering. We had a couple of out barns and sheds. We had chickens and horses and cows, and we had dairy cows. It was a Holstein farm. Scottsburn Dairy would come every X amount of days and collect the milk and the cream and so on. And I used to go in this one little shed that we had, and it was full of tools and whatnot, and I'd tinker around in there. And I mean, we lived in the country, and there was no internet, there was no cable, there was no nothing like that. You watch TV late at night, and that was it. Like, you know, there wasn't even Saturday morning cartoons when I lived there or anything like that, because you had chores to do and stuff. But I used to play in there, and for 1 week straight, he wouldn't let me play in there. He'd, you know, threaten me with the strap if I was – and take that with a grain of salt, too, because the strap thing, I mean, it was more prevalent when I was younger. Kids would more likely be, you know, beaten by their parents, spanked, or, you know, I'm not talking like I never got the crap beat out of me, so to speak, by him, but I definitely had the strap, you know. You did something wrong and you weren't sitting down for a couple hours. Whether or not it's right is not the purview of what we're going into here, but so I'm not allowed to go into this shed for a week or so. I'm a sulky, pissed off little, at this point, I think I was around 6 or 7, and I couldn't figure out why. I had nothing else to do, so I'd play with our golden retriever, Rex, and I'd sit out there by the tree, and I had a little transistor radio that, you know, thinking now, it's not that little. It's about the size of two Game Boys, if you remember the Game Boy, kind of put together like a big brick, red leather, and it took a square 9-volt battery, which you'd stick on your tongue to make sure it worked first. I'd sit there and listen to that because I always had this connection with music, but I was so pissed off. Why can't I go in the shed? What's going on? He would never quite say. And then the day came and he opens up the doors, and I didn't even know it was my birthday. And he opens up the doors and he had built me a go-kart, and it wasn't mechanical. It was one of those ones like you push it to the top of the hill and you go, and then gotta lug it back up. But I mean, this farmer, and he was not young when I was there. I'd say he was in his late 50s, early 60s. So young, I guess, by certain standards, but he wasn't like super young. And he had built it. And I remember it had a, he didn't even smoke, so I don't know where this came from, but he had a Player's Light tobacco tin, because they were tin back then, and it was the cover was the steering wheel, and I was just blown away. And to this day I think about that, and I mean, you saw me smile when I said it, because it is a fond memory. And I have love for that guy. And then there's the other side of things, you know. And I still have love for him. Him and his wife wasn't the nicest to me. She didn't really like kids, I don't think. I was one of 1, 2, 3 foster children. They had one son of their own who was in the military. He had left. And there was, there was 4 of us in total. And then we had like a young fella come and live with us from Bolivia for a while, like an exchange student. And I mean, that, you know, then the bad things that happened there, or the things that were not as cool or heartwarming, I guess. There was one time, you know, like you have to get up early to milk the cows and take in the eggs or whatever. It was my job to get the eggs. I didn't milk the cows. I was too afraid of getting kicked. But I'd go in and grab the eggs, and it's dark out. It's, you know, you're going to getting on a bus to go to school in Northport, which is just outside of Amherst. But the bus was like an hour long ride or something like that. And get up in the morning, go do that. And one time I needed to pee really bad. And I stopped in one of the out barns we had about 100 feet or so from the house was a big, almost like a garage. And there was a couple tractors in there. And we had gotten that week earlier a new, brand new red Massey Ferguson tractor. And I stopped in there to pee because I couldn't make it to the house. There's no way I was going to make it. And when I did, I was peeing on the tire of the tractor, and all of a sudden I got a steel tube boot up the side of my head thrown at me. The same man that who I tell you I have love for. Then there's the really bad, you know, I mean, that was bad. Don't get me wrong. I'm not, but then there's, time that, I have a bad stomach. And unfortunately that means sometimes that, you know, especially as a kid, you can't make it to the washroom or something. I needed to go number two, pretty bad. And Roberto, who's not my foster brother, but my brother from exchange student brother, I guess. But he was like a brother. He was in the washroom taking a shower or something. We only had one washroom, big farmhouse, and there's Lori, and there's Roberto, and my mother and my father, and two other sisters. Can't remember their names, and my brother, and these are like foster brothers and sisters. And anyway,
so there's a lot of people there.
There's a lot of people there, yeah. And I couldn't make it. Long story short, poop my pants. It's like that SNL skit. Oops, I crap myself. So I did, and my foster father came in, and he beat me, and he made me. And I've been ashamed of this for years, and there's no reason to be ashamed of it, honestly, man. It's nothing I did wrong, but I was forced to lick my underwear clean. So stuff like that is pretty fucked up if you think about it, but I still have love for him. Now, I don't have love for his wife, which is strange. It's kind of like, so there was two dogs in the house, too. There was Rex, the golden retriever that I hung out with, and he was very friendly. You know, I could basically ride him because I was such a small kid or whatever. And then there was Abercrombie. And Abercrombie, well, that dog was a dick. So he was a wiener dog. But he was her dog, like my foster mother. And she was mean. And he was mean. To this day, I tell people I have a mushroom allergy because mushrooms, it's a traumatic thing. I used to be forced to sit at the table, and I was a really slow eater, and it was probably because of my stomach issues, but I was forced to sit at the table for literally, like, I'd get home at, say, 4:30 or 3:30, whatever it was in the afternoon, and I'd be there until my bedtime at, like, 8 o'clock, and I wasn't allowed to leave the table unless I ate everything, and she would oftentimes, and she knew I didn't like it, but I think she was just a mean person. She would make cream of mushroom soup, and I'd sit there, and I'd gag, and I'd gag, and I'd gag, and I'd gag, and eventually I'd get beaten, and it would get thrown in the fridge, and I'd have to try again tomorrow. But to this day, you know, I tell people I'm allergic to mushrooms, and people say, how can you be allergic to mushrooms? There's no such thing as a mushroom allergy. It's a lot easier to say you're allergic than to say, well, I have this trauma from 30, 40 years ago. And right. So, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of weird stories like that.
Those are the big ones. It must have been really hard to go through that, man.
It was difficult. I can remember having a recurring dream, and I don't remember my dreams very often, but I remember having this recurring dream, and I liken it to, and again, big music guy, the cover of Pink Floyd's The Wall. Because in my dream, I'd be in a room, and it would just be four walls, floor and ceiling, and it was just white brick, and I'd have this recurring dream forever. And then another dream I had, which was ridiculous, is that my mother, who didn't even have her license, by the way, I gotta point that out, but my mother in some of these dreams would show up in a helicopter, flying the helicopter, I might add, in the backyard and pick me up and take me home.
Right.
Very weird.
Secret operation.
Yeah, very 007. Right. So. And then there was one more foster home after that. That was the good one. That was the one. Honestly, I went back during this journey of self-discovery. I went back and I requested all my social work, like my child protection services documents from Nova Scotia and from Prince Edward Island, because the story continues even to here. But I burned everything about 3 years ago on New Year's Eve. I said, I'm done. I'm PTSD. I'm past the shitty drama. And I mostly am, like, in that sense. Like, I could have, reading through all this, like, there's a lot of discrepancies. Like, my name, when I was growing up, I thought it was Bedford McCackern, like, until the age of 16. Even though moving here at the age of 10, after 2 days of being here, my mother changed my name. And I won't mention the name, but the lawyer in town, I remember going into the courthouse and walking up to the judge's chambers, and he said, and I didn't even know what was going on. I was taking out of school, literally thrown in a taxi and going downtown with my mother. And I'm like, what's going on? We're changing your name. What? I don't want to change my name. And the lawyer saying to me, though, when we're walking, he's like, what are you going to say when the judge asks you if you want to change your name? And I said, what if I don't want to change my name? And his response, and by the way, he's still practicing law in downtown Charlottetown right now. It pisses me off. But he said, you have to. I've done all this work, which is undue influence and coercion of a minor. It's legal. He should be barred. He should be. But again, forgiving, forgetting, I forgive him. Do I think what he did was right? Absolutely not. And I might have gone off topic quite a bit there, but.
No, so there was one more.
One more foster home, yeah.
That was a good one. And then
So, again, I thought my name was Bedford McCackern. So I now was taken to a third foster home. The reason I was taken to the third foster home, by the way, was because the mother at the second one, the one in Port Howe, the farm, him and her, like the husband and wife, had split up. And back then they said, a single man cannot be a caregiver. We're not letting it happen. So... and I was the youngest. The rest were like older than 16, and I was 8. So I was taken out of there and gone to another home, other school, other set of friends. And this was in Conn's Mills, Nova Scotia, which is rural country just outside of Pugwash. I went to Cyrus Eaton Elementary School in Pugwash. And the two people that looked after me had a ton, like not a ton of kids. They had a bunch of kids, but it was never about the money for them. They weren't well off or anything. And they were country but you know what? They were fair and they were polite and they were nice and they treated me well. And I actually made contact, with my foster father, Pup. And I think that's where some of my love of music comes from, because Pup played the fiddle. And all the other kids, so, geez, I'm just trying to think here. There was Juanita, there was Becky, there was Mark, there was, the names are failing me, but there was Dan, my nephew that I mentioned earlier, and he was just a little four-year-old curly blonde kid. And him and I, once Pop started playing the fiddle in the kitchen, because it was very down-home kind of country, you had the kitchen here, you had the wood stove here, and off that you had a bedroom where there was an older man lived. And I would go in and read him his Bible every night, because I always loved reading. But Pup would play the fiddle, and when he did, all the other kids would, they're gone. Screw this. We don't want to hear this. Dan and I would be sitting there, and we'd put our, you know, hands in our head in our hands, whatever, and just look up at him with basically adoration, like, oh, my God, this is amazing. And so I met him 31 years later or something like that. I made contact, and we had lost contact. And when I introduced myself, it's a weird story, and I'll get into it some other time because it's very quite long. But I remember Dan calling me, and he said, "I think I know who you are." And I said, "Oh," he goes, "You're Bedford." I said, "Yeah." He's like, "We always wondered what happened to you." And I'm literally a province away, but my mother had been so secretive about my past and whatnot. And I guess the reason that I didn't know my real name, you know, and getting just into that a little bit, is because my real father was abusive, and he would throw me as a baby across the room. He'd beat the crap out of my mother. He would beat the crap out of my brother, and so on and so forth. So yeah, that's. In that foster home, you know, they treated me with respect, and Pup was harsh, like not harsh. Harsh is not the term. Strict. You know, when the finger came down on the table, and you go like this, and you tap the table, and you say, mind? And if that finger went down, you knew, like, you better smarten up or else, you know, you're going to get the strap. Yes, they still use a strap and stuff back then. But I'll tell you, he talked to you like an adult. When he found out, you know, I was having trouble in school because of being bullied or whatever, he sits you down, and didn't matter what time of day. It was all about, you want a chunk of cake? And you sit there and you give this kid or, you know, a sandwich or cake or whatever, and you sit down and you talk to them like an adult and find out what's going on. And he was a really interesting guy. And Frida, his wife, or Nan, as we call her, she loved us all. And it was amazing after 30-some years to make this contact and meet Pup. And I have pictures of Pup. And when I met him, he was 90, man, I feel bad, but I think he was 97, something like that. And he had cancer multiple times, and he smoked his whole life. And, you know, he's like, why am I going to stop? Like, no, I've lived a good life. And unfortunately, I didn't get to meet my foster mother again. She predeceased him. But I got to spend, you know, 3 and 4 or 5 months going over, spending the weekend there and stuff, and being with Pop, and it was amazing. And I can remember being there one time. I even took my father-in-law one time, came over and met him, and was just blown away. And they found out they had a lot in common and whatnot. And Pop, I asked him if he'd play the fiddle for me, and he hadn't played in years. And he said, Paulette, that's my foster sister, he said, go get my fiddle. She went and got his fiddle, and he rosined up the bow, and he played Turkey in the Straw. And that really, you know, that was my childhood in parts. So I miss Pup a lot. But I made a lifelong connection over there with my nephew Dan. And, you know, I go over every once in a while and spend the weekend. He comes here, and made other friends over there, like my buddy Nick, great guy, and Crystal, his wife, and their kid Hannah, you know. So these connections kind of happened through all that, but that's the foster system. That's basically it in a nutshell. There's a lot more to it, but I mean, we could go on for hours and you'd be like, holy shit, you know, but that's it in a nutshell.
So
at that point, my mother got custody of me.
Your nephew, is that your actual nephew, by the way, or is that?
No, he's my foster nephew. So okay. He would have been one of my foster sisters in that last foster home. He would have been their son. So he was closest in age to me as a boy. So he was the one I hung out with all the time and played with. Play in the barn. And he was little. He could fit in the, you know, in the car, they have like the fabric on the roof. So we had some old junker cars in the back that we used to play in and stuff. And there'd be one that had like the fabric hanging down, and he'd get up and laying there like a camper cabin. He still talks about it to this day because he's still a scrawny little figure. Anyway, but yeah, but you know, what a dichotomy, what a difference between 1, 2, and 3. You know, yeah. I don't have any love or anything for the first lady because I didn't know her. I never got a chance to know her at all. I don't know who she is. I don't know anything about her. Even in the records, it doesn't mention her. Or didn't before I burned them, I guess. Burning them was a way of letting go as much as I could. So realizing that this is mine, this is my journey, and it's my way to get my, kind of take my life back, because a lot of my life I felt like it was taken away from me. So.
So you mentioned, like, with your name, did they change your name when you went to the foster care? Is that what happened?
No. So that was once my mother, again, my mind's kind of all over the place trying to, that's how my brain works. I've got a million different things in my brain right now. You know, I'm thinking about what to make for supper, and I'm thinking about band, and I'm thinking about, you know, so on and so forth. What it was is once my mother got custody of me when I was 10, she brought me here, and I've lived here mostly ever since. And I was here. I was in Sherwood School. I'd been in there for, you know, I think it was 1-2 days as Bedford McCackern, which you can imagine, by the way, with a name like Bedford. Bedfart.
Oh, Bedfart.
Listen, buddy, I've heard them all. You know, Yeah, there you go. Perfect. I'm glad you got to use that. Yeah. Is there an applause one too?
This thing's awesome.
So she had changed my name after being there for a couple days. So that was a huge thing. I found PEI pretty closed-minded when I first moved here. And that's not a slight against Islanders or anything. It's just the fact of when I came here. I felt that. I hated this place for a long time because of the way I was treated. In Sherwood Elementary for 2 years, grade six. First, my mother lies and puts me into French immersion, and I didn't know French at all. And I still don't. You know, I speak Sesame Street French, is what I say. Bonjour, comment ça va? You know, that sort of stuff. Du toi.
Est-ce que la toilette?
Yeah. Big Bird. No.
Anything I learned.
Yeah. So I don't speak French, and she puts me in French immersion. Like, that's really strange behavior. But unfortunately, that was my mom, and I think she did the best with what she had. I just don't think that she didn't get the support she needed. That's unfortunate. So she changes my name. And the name, by the way, is I'll call him my stepfather. They were never married. He never adopted me. He didn't want me there. But yet he was abusive in many ways. And I'm named after him. So, you know, you ask what my name is, and I'll tell you my name is Will. Legally, it's William, but it's Will. And people say, why didn't you change it? I said, well, because I've been known by, I could tell you, seriously, like, I could name them off. You know, I was known as Bedford McCackern. I didn't have a middle name that I knew of. And my father, I thought, was this guy. He was kind of like a sailor. And he was, apparently. But he was a drinker, and he was just one of mom's boyfriends, another string of abusive boyfriends. And then I was named after, originally I was named after my father. My sister told me when I was 16 and proved it to me with my baptismal certificate, which is something they would give instead of a birth certificate in Quebec in that period of time. And I didn't believe her, but then she got it, and I saw, holy shit, like I was born in Montreal, and I'm French, but I don't speak a word of French. And my name is actually not Bedford. It's not William, which I'm now known as, but it's Yvonne, you know, like Ivan, Yvonne LeMay. Man of many names. Actually, there's more. There's like she had named me after, so my brother has a different father than I do, and my sister has a different father. And for years, my sister would say stuff like, this is my half-brother, and that used to piss me off. My half-brother. Fuck off. I'm your brother, you know. And we talked about it as adults, and she gets it now, I think. But it really used to hurt. And she named me after, at one point, I can remember going by the name of Brian Bruce Wenzel. And Wenzel, Bruce Wenzel is my brother, who, by the way, is named after his father, who was predeceased. Like, he was dead before I came around. I've had a lot of names. And kids here were brutal. You know, they really were. Bullying is, I urge anybody who's being bullied to please go talk to somebody. Talk to your parents, talk to your teachers or you know, whoever, because it's a very real thing, and it can have a great impact on our mental health. And I contribute that to a lot of stuff too, because I alluded to earlier, I said I spent a lot of time in my basement alone, and I absolutely did, you know, so. Grade six twice in Sherwood, grade seven twice in Stone Park. And it's not that I'm stupid. I'm not. But I couldn't get along in school. How can you get along when you're being, you know, having the shit kicked out of you at recess, having the shit kicked out of you on the way home, having the shit kicked out of you after school, you know, being bullied in the school? In fact, I had an old teacher, and I won't mention names because I don't think that that's the way to go here. It's not my story to tell. His, but this is my story. And there was one kid who used to pick on me solid all the time. I've thrown one punch in my life, and I'm very proud of that, actually. And that one punch was against a kid named Mark. And Mark, if you're out there, you deserved it, buddy. But he was really, he used to pick on me solid, and it was school picture day. And I was the kid that was sent to school with Salvation Army rubber boots, clothes, you know, from Salvation Army, and every other kid was wearing, you know, Converse and Reebok and Nike and whatever. And I mean, while I show up in like shitty gym pants and rubber boots, and we didn't live on a farm. We lived in Sherwood. And this one kid, Mark, you know, he'd been picking quite a bit. And this one teacher took me aside and he said, listen, next time you do it, and next time he does it, just turn around, bop him in the nose. I said, no, I'll get kicked out of school and then I'll be in trouble. And, you know, I'm just a young kid. And he said, no, I promise you won't be in trouble. Or if you do, like, I'll take care of it. I said, okay, whatever. And I trusted him because he had actually been hired, I found out later on in life, by my grade six teacher, who realized that, like, once they took me out of French immersion, he realized that this kid's in danger of some sort, like whether it be family things or whatever, he's in danger. So he actually went ahead and made a contact with social services here, and they hired basically like a resource teacher who would spend time with me outside of school, almost like a big brother. He would take me and this other kid, Corey, and we'd go to Victoria Park and we'd go to the arcade and we'd go to the beaches. And it was just a thing for kids who didn't have anything, I guess. But he had said, you know, go ahead, bop him on the nose. You won't get in trouble. So here comes picture day. Pop. He had a bloody nose. I'm sure when I tell the story, I tell people I broke it. But, that, you know, I'm a storyteller. You got to embellish a little bit, right?
Broke his nose. Shattered.
Broke his nose. Shattered it into pieces like it fucking fell off and went everywhere, right?
Everybody was screaming.
But, you know, we both called into the office and he's got a bloody nose and he gets kicked out of school. And I get kicked out of school, too. For a day or something, like nothing crazy. It was my first time getting kicked out, I think. And I did get shit from it from my mother, but I felt pretty good, you know. I stood up to a bully and he never did anything again. He kind of stayed away. But I remember sitting in the principal's office, and again, I'm not going to mention names, but the principal was a really cool older gentleman. And he said, you know, William, you can't be doing this. You can't do this. I said, I understand. He said, so I do have to send you home, and you can come back tomorrow. You can come back the next day, whatever, however he worded it, I'm paraphrasing. But then he reached up and he gave me a high five, you know? So it was like, good for you for standing up for yourself. PEI was not friendly place to an outsider. If you weren't an Islander, who the fuck are you? You know, and that was the kind of the impression I got. I also didn't play sports. I didn't get into hockey. I love hockey now. I can't skate, but I love hockey. I played street hockey for like 4 or 5 years straight out behind Charlottetown Mall with a big crew back in the early 90s and such. Every kid was into hockey. I wasn't. And so that was one thing. It's a strike against you. You have your clothes. That's a strike against you. You have your weird mother. That's a strike against you. You have this kid who doesn't even know who the hell he is. That's a strike against you. And I can remember walking home, you know, getting kicked in the back by my quote unquote best friend, who I'm quite happy to say, you know, and only because it's almost like vindication a little bit. Ended up in prison later on in life, and spent some time incarcerated, you know. But I mean, we're walking home and he's my best, quote, best friend. And because he had gotten in with some cooler kids, all of a sudden I'm kicked in the back and like beaten into a ditch, you know. And then there's, you know, Stone Park coming home one day. I'm walking again with a different, quote, best friend. And I seem to have this problem. I don't know. Like, it's almost like the weak were preyed on or something. You know, in the Simpsons, there was like Lisa one time, I think it was, I forget his name, but one of the characters, Nelson, he says, do you smell nerd sweat? You know, and it was, so it's kind of like that. And yeah. I was walking home one time from Stone Park with my other best friend, and I was getting into skateboarding at the time. And this was my first go at Stone Park, because I'd been there for 2 years in grade seven. And I'm literally, so my house was on Heather Avenue, and it was, the soccer field and you have Stone Park right behind the soccer field. So you'd walk through the soccer field to get to my house because I was two houses away from the soccer field on the same side. So you'd walk down and cut across. And so I'm walking with this guy, and I won't say his name. I've talked to him since. And he takes his skateboard and smashes me across the back and beats the living shit out of me, all while my neighbor, who owned a watch store in Charlottetown, I won't mention names, infer from that what you will, sat there with a cigarette watching this happen, and then flicks his cigarette. And I'm literally getting the shit kicked out of me in the ditch, like crying a whole bit, you know, and this other kid beating me with a skateboard. And he flicks his cigarette onto his lawn and walks in his house. But that's PEI.
Jesus Christ.
You know.
That sounds like a movie, like a mob boss, like calls a hit. You're just like watching it.
Right. But that's kind of what I felt PEI was like for a long time. Look the other way. Look the other way. Don't talk about it. Look the other way. So I was, you know, a lot of the neighborhood kids I wasn't allowed to hang around with, again, because of my mother and whatnot. I'd forgotten about this, but I read about it in the report through, because remember I said I got the documents from Nova Scotia and PEI for my child protection services. But when I first came here and my mother got custody of me, they found me at one point in my neighbor's house overnight. Because my mother she worked for Bill Lynch shows. She'd be gone all summer long. So I'm staying here with her boyfriend, William, you know. And he, like I said, he didn't want me there, whatever. And I can remember, after reading about it, I can remember. But the neighbors had found me in their son's room, like a sleepover. He was having a sleepover, and I was there, and I wasn't invited or anything, but I was just there. And the reason is because I didn't want to go home. You know, I was being abused at home. I was William or Bill, who I'm named after, he was mentally, physically, and sexually abusive. And he didn't like me from day one when, he actually met me at the last foster home in Conn's Mills. One time my mother got permission to take me for the weekend, and she came over with him because she doesn't drive, or she didn't drive. And, you know, here I am, I'm at the time 8 or 9. So, and he's talking about if I've had sex with my foster sister. Did you do this to her? Did you do this to her? And so on and so forth. So he wasn't a great guy. But again, I don't have love for him, but I think back on him and I forgive him and I think, what happened to you? And that's what I think about all the bullies. What happened to you? You know, except for one. There's one I have a real hard time. I don't know why, but I have a real hard time getting over what he did to me. So, but also when I was in Stone Park, I guess. I kind of jumped there. So William, or Bill as he was known, my mother was away all summer long, and he'd be taking care of me. And taking care of me meant locking the doors, locking me out of the house, letting me in when he had to, you know, when it was dark out. So I spent a lot of time couch surfing when I was younger. I was the first time I had kind of left home, you know, really like left home was probably around 12, because I was just, I couldn't do it. I couldn't take it anymore. But he had a boss who had a cottage out in Stanhope. And I remember going out there, and he brought some random woman with us. And his intention was to clearly, you know, cheat with her. And she didn't want none of it. She was drunk, and he plied her with liquor and, you know, whatever. But I said, I'm going to tell Mom. And that was it. Like, I was never, you know, I never had, there was never the ball tossed. There was never the closest it got. And there were times that he was okay to me. Don't get me wrong. Like, I'm not saying he was always fucking evil. He wasn't, you know. And maybe some of it might have been Stockholm syndrome-ish. I don't know. But, like, I can remember going to Maid Marian's on, like, Wednesday nights or something every once in a while. Not all the time, but, like, it was, like, burger night, right? And so we go to Maid Marian's and have burgers, and that was a big thing. But, like, I never went to McDonald's. I never had birthday party. I never had, you know, you didn't toss the ball around with your dad or anything like that. I never had that stuff. So, and the first time I kind of realized all of this was wrong, not that stuff, but like my life in general and my past with my foster homes and stuff. And I told you this before, was driving with my girlfriend at the time, who later on became my wife. And everyone's talking in the car about when their parents would catch them doing this or that and beat them. And I told the story about getting hit in the head with the steel toe boot, and the car went silent. Mm. And I thought, what the fuck's going on here? And it was like, you guys live Leave It to Beaver. You guys live this amazing family life that I don't understand other than TV. I see it on The Cosby Show. I see it on, you know, not to mention Bill Cosby, but I'm, you know, you saw it on TV. And so my family, to me, were, you know, once I came living with my mother, they were my friends, who, again, sometimes would just turn against you for no reason, it felt like. And but a lot of my time was spent, you know, like my friends were SNL as I got older. You know, I religiously watched Saturday Night Live because I realized I have a sense of humor, and I have to, because otherwise I'm going to be dead, you know. I found out later in life, because I'm still friends with that one teacher who told me to bop that guy in the nose. In fact, I do go out and visit him in the summers and spend some time at his cottage and stuff, and go out and sit down. He doesn't really go anywhere, but I'll bring him a coffee and, you know, we'll sit and shoot the shit. And, geez, I kind of lost my train of thought there. I'm not going to lie. I got a lot going on, but,
So you're still friends with,
I'm still friends with, oh yeah. So he had told me one time, and I'm paraphrasing here a little bit, but you'll get the gist of it, that in the teacher's lounge where they, you know, back then they were allowed to smoke and whatnot, they were all sitting around having a smoke. And I came up as a topic of discussion because I would have been labeled a problem child, I guess. Right. But I wasn't a bad kid. I really wasn't. I got in shit a lot, but usually at the expense of other people and my reactions to those other people. So, for example, somebody's sitting there and they're flicking your ear or they're punching you in the back constantly, but the teacher doesn't see it, right? And then you get up and you're like, ah, you know, whatever, freaking out at them. Who do you think gets shit on?
You get in trouble, right?
Right. So, I mean, I got kicked out of Colonel Gray. But like, I have one grade 10 credit. Technically, like, the last grade I passed was probably grade 5. You know, grade 6, I failed because I got kicked out so much because I was being picked on and being bullied and abused at home, and nobody caught this, which is weird because if you read the files, you'd go through it and you'd go, holy shit, like, they've gotten reports of this, 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 and this. Why did no one step in? But that's something else I found with me, is that with PEI later in life, I tend to fall through the cracks. You know, I mentioned, I can't say who I worked for or anything, but I was fired while off on mental health leave. Like, that's a human rights violation, but I fell through the cracks. So I still talked to him, and he had said, that teacher, that they were sitting around talking about me, and they had kind of said they would be shocked if I didn't kill myself by the age of 16. And I heard that around the age of 16. And you got to remember, then I was starting to, you know, get a little taller, a little bigger. And I'm not like, I'm a big guy, but I'm not like built, but I'm a big guy. I'm not fat, but I'm a big guy. I'm 6 foot and I weigh 300 pounds. People are like, you weigh 300 pounds? Holy shit. But I had started skateboarding and whatnot, and I had that attitude of fuck the world and fuck you and fuck corporate and fuck society and all this. And it came from a place of being very hurt. But one of the things I did is I said, fuck you, I'm not going to be a statistic. And I don't mean that in a negative way to anybody who's gone through that, obviously. And if you're suffering with that, please reach out and get help, mental health support lines, suicide prevention lines, what have you. But that really spurred me on. It pissed me off enough to be here, I think, for the most part.
That's probably the best reaction you could have had to that, I think.
I think so, yeah. So thanks for pissing me off. Grade six, I appreciate it. Thank you, Sherwood School. I'm here to tell my story. But again, you know, you can laugh, and I'm sarcastic. So if any of this is coming off and rubbing people the wrong way, I apologize. And you can reach me at, you know, somewhere. So that's, yeah, that's kind of how it happened.
So I guess how was the process of processing all this and getting diagnosed? And, you know, you talked a lot about in the beginning about ways that you cope. So how has that been for you? Just that whole coming to understand.
Sure. Yeah. Well, first thing I'll say, and I don't know if I said this earlier or if I said it to you outside when we were kind of chatting before this, but everything's it's a tool. It's something that you have to cope with, to deal with, or to work through different mental health situations and whatnot. And whether it be your medication, whether it be your meditations, or whatever it is, it's not one thing that's going to work. And that's something I've been trying to speak with my friends about too. Like, this one thing is not going to fix everything. You're not going to go to therapy and instantly feel better. I don't believe. Now, maybe some people do. Maybe I'm just, but I am. Everything's got to be skewed through your own lens, right? A little bit. And I believe that everything kind of works in concentration, coordinated effort together. And does it always work? No. But so I was working for a company, and I had been a financial advisor with a grade six education, grade five education. I was managing, it wasn't a lot. It sounds like a lot, but it really wasn't. It was like $4.2 million in Charlottetown. But I mean, hey, I did that. Clap in the back, you know. but I was finding it very stressful, very hard to gain new business, very hard that I wasn't an Islander even, I found. Strangely enough, when I would mention where I was from and stuff, I got kind of shut off from a lot of people. Oh, jeez. Are you a shyster? You know, what's going on here? Previous to that, I had worked at CIBC for 6 years. And I never once lied, by the way, about my education. I just never told them. But then later on, we'd be sitting there and they'd be asking, like, so where did you go to school? And I'd be like, oh, well, I went to Sherwood Elementary and I went to Stone Park and I went to Colonel Gray. Oh, and did you take college? Well, yeah, I took marketing in Holland College. Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, but I quit that after about, you know, 5 months because I went to Europe, you know? So yeah. Does that really kind of make sense? I guess. Like,
yeah.
It's, so I'm working this job and I had been the financial advisor and now I'm selling internet basically door to door. Because I'm not afraid to talk to people. That's something weird too. I'm not afraid to get up and stand in front of 1,000 people and talk. I've done it. You know, as a financial advisor, I held it wasn't 1,000 people, but it was like 100 people standing there. And I've given presentations to RCMP officers and, you know, whatnot. And it never bothered me. But I was going door to door and I just kept constantly having these kind of breakdowns where I was like, I can't do it. And that's the other thing too. So going back to the employment thing, you know, asking like, well, why is it that you can't, work doesn't seem to work out for you, for lack of a better term. What you find to be meh, like just a little thing, depending on the given day, depending on the chemical imbalance in my brain, because let's be honest, that's what it is. We know that. Scientifically, we know that. But based on the chemical imbalance in my brain, maybe that little thing to me is a mountain. And it's fucking driving me nuts. It's making me sad. It's making me remember. It's making me live in my past. It's pissing me off because I'm watching this guy squash the little guy. I hate that. Like, I hate it, right? You know, like, I can remember one time seeing the police just up here, and they had some kid who looked to be about 16 years old, and he was a big kid, but they had him down on the ground, and he was crying and they had his back, like his arms behind his back and the knee in his back. And I'm sitting there and I'm basically filming it. And my wife she didn't understand. what are you doing? Don't do that. Don't do that. I said, bullshit. I'm doing this because I can't stand to see the little guy get put trounced down and fall through the cracks. And, you know, we all need to be treated with that respect. And so I'd been taking those kind of panic attacks. I didn't know what they were. I'd end up on the side of the road, a puddle of tears, or I'd end up, you know, I'm supposed to be over in Stratford knocking on doors, or I'm supposed to be, because you were assigned areas to sell the internet packages or whatever. And I'd be out at Brackley Beach calling my friend and saying, I don't know what to do. I'm sitting here and oh, no problem. I'll come out and I'll meet you. I'd sit there and my employer would say, what did you do today? And I'd say, oh, I'd hit this many calls or whatever. And I'd fudge the numbers a little bit because I was afraid to get fired, which of course I ended up not getting fired, but I quit because I ended up going somewhere else and finding something better at the time. But everything kind of happens for a reason too. I think there's a reason we're here today.
Like talking to people, like going up and knocking on the door, that really kind of set off the panic attacks.
It wasn't so much knocking on the door. It was kind of my past. I used to say my past doesn't define me. And in a way it doesn't, but in a way that's total bullshit. You know what I mean? I'm a creative guy. I could sit here right now, and if I hadn't told you any of this, you'd never know, because I can fake it inside. I could be fucking dying. And what I was finding is I was sitting on the side of the road. Like, I didn't even know why, but everything was crashing in on me. All this stuff from my past, being abused mentally, physically, sexually, you know, whatever, being abandoned, it all came back. Being bullied, it all came back. And I spent some very angry time over the next couple of years. And now we're 6-7 years in of a diagnosis, and I get it. I get what they mean now. You know, and it's a shame. Not that, you know, hindsight being 2020, it's a shame that we didn't know back then about PTSD and whatnot. Nobody caught that, but we know that PTSD survivors, and that's what I am. I'm a survivor. We tend to, our neuron pathways are damaged somehow, whatever that is, and those electrons that travel around the neuron pathways or the neuron highway in your brain, they don't make the same connections, or they take circuitous route to get there, kind of, you know, you might go to Tim Hortons by going straight, and I might go by taking a left turn, another left turn, right turn, you know, so on and so forth, and then I'm there, but I might be there, you know, a little later or whatnot. So it's just because of the way that happens, finding out more about yourself or myself really during all this process. It was my doctor's recommendation and my therapist's recommendation that I'd be off work because I had taken more panic attacks at work and would be in a puddle of tears in an office building. And I didn't know why. You know, what the fuck's going on with me? Why am I sitting here? Why am I feeling like the world is literally crushing the air out of me? Why am I feeling less than? And I felt less than my whole life because I was made to feel less than. I was the dog that got beat, you know, and I'm not giving you a poor me story. And that, by the way, for anyone listening, like, yes, it's my story, but I don't have the poor me's. I never did. So my past does define me, but it's how I choose to go forward with it. And how I choose to go forward with it is stuff like this. Like, let's sit down and have these conversations. Let's realize that there's something really fucked up about the lack of attention and detail given to mental health and mental health in children and so on and so forth. And, you know, I'm sure, and I know for a fact, and I've never talked to them about it. You know, some of my old bosses, like, they might hear this, or they might be thinking, what was wrong with that guy? Like that loss of a sale or whatever, or whatever it would be, could be so minor of a detail. And he's sweating and he's like, oh, you know, he's really pissed off and he's in my face but how do you cope with things if you don't know how to cope with things? You know, how do you ride a bike if you're not taught to ride a bike? How do you, like, you can jump on, sure, and maybe you can learn it, but if you don't even know there's a bike, now you got a different problem altogether, right? And if you don't know there's something, I'm not going to say wrong, something different. Because wrong is, like we talked earlier about the word commit. It's got to go away, you know. And I believe that once you know better, you do better. And so here we are. Yeah. I don't know what else to say to that.
I guess just like a two-part question, maybe to wrap things up.
Sure.
Like, think about what have been the biggest things like that have helped you cope, and then what would be your advice to someone that is in a similar position or maybe just got diagnosed with PTSD?
Sure, yeah. Well, ways to cope, I mean, for me, mindfulness meditation is huge. I've kind of fallen off the wagon a little bit in terms of mindfulness meditation lately, and I am trying to get back into it. My wife, I just have so much love for her, but she has this board she puts on on the fridge. She does it every month. She writes down 1, 2, 3, 4, right up to 30, 31, 28, whatever it is for the month. And she doesn't put the days, but she, you know, and it used to be meditate and move, but now she knows I'll move, right? Like I'll get out and I'll go for a hike and I enjoy these things. But she puts it up there and I check it off. So meditation is big for me. Music is huge. I didn't realize I had any talent in anything ever in my life. I was, like I said, I was made to feel less than. When you're not, you know, when you're not the hockey kid with the hockey kids, you're nothing. You know, back then, you were nothing. Like, you don't matter. You know, I've been told in my adult life that I'm not going to get this promotion at a business because I'm not good enough looking. Or, like, literally told that by people. And these are people that people, like. So I go back and I go, that's interesting. I wonder if everyone knows that that person's actually got these tendencies to be a piece of shit like we all are. But do they realize that that person, hopefully they've changed. Like when I say I couldn't forgive that one guy, I'm not going to mention his name, but I will say some details. And if you infer it, you infer it. But, I mean, this guy accosted me one time in the Confederation Court Mall. I had my ear pierced. He showed up with a bunch of friends in something called the Subway Gang back in the day. What a stupid name that was. Stupid thing. They were rolling old people for their money, like literally made the news and stuff. And anyway, so he shows up and he gets in my way and I say, you know, leave me alone. I have my headphones on. I'm listening to, at the time, it was probably Anthrax because I was really into skateboarding and stuff. And I was wearing the trench coat. And it was all long before a terrible tragedy at Columbine and whatnot. And I was a good kid. I just didn't want to be around bullshit. And I didn't want to be bullied anymore. And he reaches up and rips out my earring and there's blood pouring down. The security guard comes running. At the time, the police station was across the street, kind of on Queen Street there, and kind of the corner of Queen and Kent. And the police officer takes the statement from the security guard and he tells him, well, he's like, well, I didn't see what happened, but, you know, here's what happened from what I saw. Like, these guys are standing there. All of a sudden, this guy's bleeding and he's got blood dripping into his hand in a pool. And this guy, who later on went on to box for the Canada Games for PEI, wasn't from here. He was an outsider, but he was accepted. Maybe because he was a jock, I'm not sure. But he used to beat the shit out of me all the time and stuff and bully me. And then he did this. And we were at the police station, and the police said, what happened? And he said, oh, well, you know, I bumped into him and by accident, and his earring caught on my shoulder and it ripped it out. And they say, okay. And I'm like, bullshit. And I told them the story of what happened. And they said, well, what do you want to do about it? I said, well, I was done. Like, at this point I was considering ending my life because I was just so sick of being hurt constantly. And I said, I want to press charges. And the police officer looked at me and said, no. And so he walked out and I walked out and that was it. But unfortunately, my interactions with the police over the years have not been good. They've been all very much like that for me. And that's not indicative of the police. That's just, for some reason, what's happened in my life. And I have a really hard time forgiving that one guy. In fact, 5 or 6 years ago, you know, coping and everything, but I started going to the gym for the first time in my life and just really enjoying doing cardio and whatnot. And I remember I got up on the heavy bag and I took a video of it and I was beating the shit out of it. And then I then took like the camera and faced it to me and I talked to him and I sent it to him and I look at his picture on Facebook. Like I stalked him, to be honest. I stalked him. I reached out to all my old bullies. I said, why did you do this? Some of them said, oh, well, if you did it, you deserved it. Which I said, that's kind of a bullshit answer, but okay. And some of them never responded. And he was one of the ones that never responded. But I see in the picture, he's got like a beautiful wife and nice looking kids and everything. And I think, oh my God. And they're wearing boxing gloves. And I think, don't make them dicks like you were. Don't do that to them. You know, that's not okay. Anyway, so the coping mechanisms, going back to that, are all the tools in your repertoire that you can use. And those are mine. And talking's huge. I think the advice for anybody, be open to talking about it, because there's nothing to be ashamed of. Nothing I've said here today is anything I've done to be ashamed of. Nothing that I'm sure most of the people who come in here talking to you, you know, you don't need to be ashamed of your mental health. We have organs in our body and we have, you know, the heart, the liver, the lungs, blah, 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 whatever. One of those is the brain. And in school, for example, you're taught academically and you're taught some physical education, and maybe it's getting better now, but for years you didn't talk about mental health. Somebody like me would be the guy with bad nerves when I was a kid. You don't go near their house because they have bad nerves. You know what? Yeah, sure. Maybe I don't want a bunch of kids running around my yard, but I think I'm a nice guy. I want to meet people and I want to make connections and I want to hear stories. I want to find things that get you excited because I like making people happy. I like making people laugh. Making people laugh is probably my biggest thing. It's my biggest coping mechanism too. And it's a way of deflecting sometimes too. So, but make those connections, talk to people openly. Don't be ashamed. We're long past the days of Cheers, the sitcom. And the reason I mention that is because I believe that, so my generation are not overly open, but we're the generation I feel like that's kind of getting there somewhat. And then the next generation is a little more open, and so on and so forth. But if you look back at Cheers, the reason it was so popular is because, and it was a truth, after World War II, and this is my belief, after World War II, because of all the traumas that people witnessed and the tragedies and the horrors of war, and God, I can't even imagine once people are going through fighting in the UK and, or sorry, in the Ukraine right now, not the UK. And they wouldn't talk to their families. They wouldn't talk to anybody about what they'd seen, a lot of people. And we know this. It's a very common trope. And what they would do is they would go and they would drink. That was their coping mechanism. They wouldn't do cannabis because cannabis wasn't legal. And cannabis, even when I was growing up, I thought it was so evil. Like, I know people when I was 16, when I was a skateboarder, if I found out that you did cannabis, I was taught that it was so bad. Literally, I'd be like, I'm not your friend anymore type of deal. And I, you know, sorry, Jesse, not my mother. My mother was Jesse, but another Jesse that I was friends with, he was a kind of a hippie kid and he smoked pot. And I didn't know. I thought he was a fucking, like some big narco or something from Mexico. And it turns out, no, he's just coping. And cannabis helps me cope. So that's another coping mechanism for me. And I am an advocate and I do have a prescription, but, and I think it's for the right person in the right instance. Yeah, that's pretty much all I could say on Cheers again. Sorry. My mind is all over the place and I apologize about that. It's part of who I am, but on Cheers, going in and talking to your bartender became your therapist. You didn't talk about feelings, especially if you're a guy. You don't talk about feelings if you're a guy. So if you're watching this, if you're listening to this and you're a guy, don't talk about feelings. You know that, right? Okay, that's bullshit. Talk about your feelings. You know, even tropey things like, and I said this to you the other day, about taking a bath. like it became even like friends made fun of it, you know, where taking a bath for a guy was like, ha ha ha, whatever, you know, whatever the term of the day was or whatever the hurtful terms, or laughing because it's considered feminine or whatnot. And I thought, you know, I came to this realization. I was like, wait a minute. What the fuck do you think cowboys and knights and so on and so forth, these typical tough guys of cinema, how did they bathe? They didn't have showers, you know? They didn't have fucking Dyson jet spas and, you know, like they literally got into a tub, copper tub filled with hot water or whatever the case may be, and they took a bath. But that didn't make them any less manly. But it made North American society less manly over the years. Why is that? Because of stigmatisms. Or stigmas, not stigmatisms, sorry. Stigmatisms are in your eyes. Or astigmatism. But stigmas. And so please talk about it. Reach out. I am open anytime to talk to anybody. And I don't care. Like I'll put my number out there. It's 902-314-9399. And if you're thinking of hurting yourself or if you just need someone to talk to, please reach out to me because I've seen it happen. I've been there. And if I can prevent one, if I can help one person, then I've done what I'm here for because I'm not going to be defined by my career. You know, my mother-in-law, I love her. She said one day, she said, you know, that person talking about somebody who had passed away. And she said, they worked hard their whole life. And I said to her, I said, what did they do? Because I feel like a bit of a sham, you know, because I don't work. But that's not what I'm meant to do. I'm meant to help people in some capacity. So please reach out. It's very important.
That's awesome, man. And thank you for putting that out there.
Of course.
And, thank you for doing what you're doing. Check out your podcast.
The Hip Chronic. It's all one word, The Hip Chronic. And yes, I smoke pot on air as well sometimes. It's all about my life. Sometimes it's stupid. Sometimes it's funny. Sometimes it's informative. The first episode actually deals with suicidal thoughts. The second episode's coming out soon. It's going to deal with resonance. So stay tuned for that, I guess. And yeah, I thank you for having me on here as well. I think this is an incredible thing you're doing. And definitely on behalf of the mental health community, please keep up the good work because this is what we need. We need real conversations. This is not scripted. Like if anybody's watching, you see I have a notepad here. I have a notepad because can tell how scattered my brain is. I'll write things down. Now, I wasn't very good at it today, but I'll write things down. And but this is a very real conversation.
Yeah.
So.
Sure. So. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for coming on, Will.
Absolutely. Sure, thank you. Cheers, buddy.